This is Geek Gab with your hosts, Dornall and me, Daddy Warpig. We are back, Geek Gab for Monday, February 26, 2024. Honest to gosh, I almost said 2022.
What's that?
I have no idea. I remember 2022. That was an awful year. I mean, not that 2024 is going to be a, you know, benchmark year for itself, but still, I was like, I do not want to be whisked back in time to 2022.
No, it's best to look to the future. We are in the future now.
The future's so bright, I gotta wear shades. Have you ever heard that song?
I don't think so. Who does
really?
It?
I am somehow ineffably disappointed. I'll have to introduce you to that song at some point. It's a great little song. It sounds like, you know, the guy says, I'm doing all right, getting good grades. The future's so bright, I gotta wear shades. It sounds like this upbeat, it's this upbeat pop song, and it sounds like this guy's saying everything's great and stuff. But what he's really talking about is nuclear explosions.
Of course.
Came out in the 80s, you know, so that shouldn't surprise you. But it's a fun song.
Those were the times.
I liked it, yeah. So we lost another character this week in D&D.
Oh boy! You know, we did. We had a great game this week. Just in case you're wondering, the great success of Trollopolis campaign continues. We had 9 players last time we talked. This past week we had 7, and it's you're right. Unfortunately, when the higher level characters are busy training or off doing something, we just can't keep level 1 characters alive. Do you remember what happened?
We went chasing after a running orc who was the last survivor of a little orc war band that we ran into, and we chased him down to the 3rd level. And we were searching for him, and a bunch of orcs released or unleashed a horde of giant centipede on us. And we did some cunning things to thin their numbers before they even got to us. And then we were engaging them in melee and killing them quickly. But one of them got to the cleric and bit him, and he died of poison.
Terrible situation, really terrible situation. And it's one of those things, and this is a great preview because I'm taking notes now. Thank you, because I haven't written the session report for that one yet, but it'll be up on my blog later this week. Dornall.blogspot.com, I believe is the plug. But it was one of those situations where you guys pretty much did everything right. Regarding the centipedes, making great use of lighted oil to thin the numbers, and putting your toughest characters up front, including the character who died, who was a level 1 cleric with decent armor. Unfortunately, everything that needed to go wrong, and this character shouldn't have died. Like, you guys actually put your best foot forward. First of all, you lost initiative on a round in which you could have easily wiped out the monsters. So all remaining monsters, I think it was 7 of them, got to make their attacks. The cleric was one of the characters you put in the front to take the brunt of the attacks because he has a very high armor class and very unlikely to be hurt by them. They just wouldn't be able to chew through the armor. And on top of that, level 1 clerics have a very good saving throw versus poison. They're very resistant to poison. You know, God's looking down on them. He's looking out for them. All told, not only did I need to roll, a maximum initiative dice, I needed to roll, basically, I think I only hurt him on an 18 or better on the dice. I rolled a natural 20. So I basically only could have hit him on that. And then he only dies on his saving throw if he rolls a 5 or less. And it happened. What are you going to do? Yep. Sometimes it just breaks that way.
And we had this debate. This was the next debate that came up. I think the last debate that was roaring online was fudging dice rolls. So we've been in the midst of this debate about whether or not you should fudge dice rolls. And the interesting point that came out of this debate that I immediately rushed to write down in the Game Master's session was Gary Gygax. Everybody says it was Gary Gygax saying you should fudge dice rolls, but that's not what he says in the DMG. What he says in the DMG is that as the game master, you should be aware of when you don't have to roll the dice, of when you don't have to leave it up to chance just because you think that in this specific instance, it's not necessary to roll the dice. But once you roll the dice, you let the dice fall where they may. In this instance, and I'm not saying you shouldn't have had him roll or anything. I'm just saying this has been the most recent tete-a-tete between... not John Mollison and several of the peoples in the Bro OSR and other OSR types on Twitter has been them saying, no, you don't roll the dice. You shouldn't roll the dice. Or you don't fudge the dice. You shouldn't fudge the dice. You've got to let the dice be honest. And in this case, the person lost a character, and last week the same person had lost a character in the big massacre we talked about on the last show. I had to make a new character this week because my other character may or may not be alive. So it's just one of those instances where the dice rolls went bad and we didn't get hardly any treasure or hardly any XP, so we're going to have to come back next week and try it all again.
Yeah, and that's the hard part too. When you sort of don't get any decent rewards out of it after having a couple of tough breaks. But and we were just talking about that in the back channel about the level of rewards. It's been very feast and famine, in terms of rewards. But when you're feasting and you're playing one-to-one time, your characters that hit those big scores, they're busy. They're spending that money, right? And they're not going to be ready to play in the following week. So people have to just buck up and play what they're gonna. If you want to play, got to bring someone new, play the B team if you want, and then stuff like this happens. But we got a really good advantage out of that scenario the past couple of sessions, which is between having new level one characters and having new players in the game. We had two new players.
And the whole mono party thing that you were talking about. Bradford Walker pipes up. Hey man, good to see you. He says it's a leisure pursuit. Don't play if you don't want to. Right. This is one of those things where people feel like they're entitled. Well, sometimes it's you and your four friends. You will get together every week and you play. Yeah, everybody should be able to play. But you don't have to play your main character.
Go play Champions or something. Play a superhero game if you want that sort of action. But, you know, I digress. With the new players, we had a renewed focus on sort of back to basics, right? Hey, how do we execute a dungeon crawl competently? Hey, we're tired of having, the players are tired of having poor maps. You know, they took the time, paid attention to, you know, my description, made sure that they had, you know, using online tools and graph paper to get some decent maps down for themselves so that they're not, you know, they're kind of half winging it for some of the other sessions, right? And it allowed me to, go ahead.
We had three different maps done by three different players, and they disagreed with each other at critical points.
Yep. And one of the players had a, what's it called? Had a map, but he was so, he was off on so much of it that when we had that elevator trap that killed everybody, he was convinced that it was the same elevator trap he saw before. So this is the guy who's been mapping consistently the whole time. And still, still didn't have the map down right. But what are you going to do?
Yeah, this is something that you don't get out of like Pro Tools or one of those other places where, you know, it's kind of like the video game Baldur's Gate, where you would wander around a level, and as you walk through the level reveals itself. So you've got a perfect map as you go through. And it's the same with Pro Tools or D&D Online or whatever. You always have a perfect map because it does the mapping for you.
Yep.
Because it's just revealing a level. When you're forced to map for yourselves, you may not get it completely correct. And that's actually a good thing. Because it becomes a challenge that you have to work through. And what I was actually thinking as we were going through this map is, this is when a dwarf would come in really handy.
Yeah. There's actually been a couple of times where I double checked the party roster. Hey, do they have a dwarf? Because I could give them information right now. Nope. It is what it is. And that's sort of one of the beauties of it. I think a lot of players who are spoiled by the, how do I put it? Spoiled by the computer game thing, as you said, or spoiled by, you know, your sort of conventional type of game where a lot of this information, or it's not deemed important, right? There's a lot of players get in this headspace where, you know, doing that sort of management of resources, counting torches and you know, that's fiddly stuff. I don't want to do that. You know, let's get to the adventure. But when you take it seriously and, you know, there's a great deal of unknown about the place that you're exploring, it actually creates a kind of excitement and tension and danger. You know, it's genuinely fun, even though sometimes it's a little bit of bookkeeping, right? And I love that. I love that every time everybody puts their heads together, they start talking about the map. And I'm looking down at my, you know, which should be the canonical map, and I go, I'm not sure they... Like, there's some miscommunication there. And that's a good thing, believe it or not. Maybe it's not good for the players, but, you know.
That was something else that someone made a comment about in one of these discussion threads that passed by my feed. They said, well, I as a GM am not going to let my players or make my players suffer through keeping track of ammo or encumbrance or torches. And I just remember, and I don't remember what blog I read it on, but where players took the logistical challenges of doing a dungeon delve and used some of the treasure they had acquired to set up a supply pipeline to the dungeon. And, you know, got a regular set of porters, built storage rooms, basically occupied the first level of the dungeon and turned it into a forward operating base. And so by closely tracking encumbrance, by closely tracking arrow expenditures, by closely tracking food and water and light, it forced the players to be creative. It increases their engagement with the game world. It increases the verisimilitude of the game world. It takes you away from being a sort of Doom clone or a COD clone into being a role-playing game where you buy into the reality of this fictional world you're exploring. I'm not saying you have to be advanced squad leader on D&D, but the more players are forced to face problems and forced to create ingenious solutions to those problems, the more real the world seems and the more rewarding it is for players to be able to create their own infrastructure and rely on it. And I think that is such an important part of the game that people miss out on if they just take all of the inconvenient parts of the game and get rid of them.
Absolutely. And it creates that situation where, you know, you get these inverted priorities where players are, you know, so focused on like playing their main guy and powering him up and doing cool stuff that you end up doing dungeons and crap, you know, for their entire careers. That's no good. That doesn't help anybody. It dissuades them from doing, you know, the really fun stuff, like actually interacting with the world and building out that world. They could develop the world by interacting with it on that level. Oh, we need to generate safe areas. We need to generate supply depots. We need to, you know, generate economic forces. We need to find markets for our goods and supplies that we need, right? That sort of thing. All that stuff that actually goes into making the world interesting. They get to do that.
I mean, you can see a group of players who, as they did in Trilopolis, renovate a keep that's close to the dungeon, and then wanting to bring in settlers to provide food, farmers and things like that, and bringing in lumbermen to provide, you know, wood for various things in need, but also who can provide food for the town that's growing and then sell off the excess lumber to provide economic activity to support shops to come into the area just because they need a solid base to keep on going after this, whatever's going on in the dungeon. That's the kind of gameplay that AD&D, as originally created, contemplates. But if you take away the quote-unquote inconvenient parts of the game, you take away all the incentives for players to begin thinking along those lines, to begin thinking in that direction.
Absolutely. Well said. And that's what we're trying to do here. That's what one-to-one time does. That's what actually taking games like AD&D, absolutely, the inconveniences are vital to the game, right? They're a part of the game. If you take these games seriously, if you try to, you know, figure out what they were doing, especially in these old school games like AD&D, you know, that's part of the game. You know, just to repeat what I was saying before, like, it may feel stupid to sort of have a piece of paper and track down little silly things like food and whatever, for food and water and torches for your expedition. But you do that, and then you actually start, and this is my personal thing. This is whenever, if you're ever wondering, like, why is John being, you know, asking the players to do this and that? Why did John make, you know, everybody go shopping in the big city to sell off their magical item, right? Why did the DM do that? That's not something we normally do, that sort of thing. It's because it's important to me that the players honestly interact with the game as if they're characters in this world. And once they start ignoring things or acting, behaving in a way that doesn't make sense, that sounds like something that someone who, they act like people who aren't part of this world are acting, then it's time to take a step back. Okay, you know, are we misapplying some rules? Are we missing some opportunities to sort of have them, you know, take over those roles? Are they really thinking like someone in world, or have they started thinking like it's a video game? Right. And that's one of my things as a game master. I want to make sure that I think everybody's going to have the most fun when they're present in the game world, when they have that mindset. It lets you truly, you know, think about the characters and what you want to accomplish in this world.
And again, we talked about this a couple of weeks ago. The game part of a role-playing game is about players overcoming obstacles by using their own ingenuity. And they can't do that if there aren't any obstacles. And by removing all of the annoying things, you're removing all of the difficulties that they have to think around. So you're removing the things that make it challenging. You're removing the things that make it a game. Now you can go too far the other way. You can, you know, start adding stupid things like, oh, well, we'll make it more challenging by adding all this stuff. There's a balance. But by and large, tracking encumbrance, tracking food and water, those are the kinds of things that are real world, that would happen in the real world, even in AD&D. And those are the kinds of things, therefore, that provide challenges while increasing the verisimilitude or the believability of the world. They make the world feel real. They make the game world feel real. So that's a win-win there. When I first talked about that, the definition of game, it is not complete in and of itself. So role-playing games have three parts. There is the role, there's the game, there is the play, and there is the role. A role-playing game is a game in which the players take on a role and face obstacles set up by the game master use their innate ingenuity, limited by the role or enhanced by the role, to overcome those obstacles in search of some reward. That is the game part. That's the definition of the game. Now, the play is when the game master describes the situation, asks the players what they're going to do, they tell him what they're going to do, he adjudicates the results using the rules of the game, and asks them, then describes the new situation and asks them what they're going to do. That's the play, the gameplay loop. So we have the game, we have the play, and then there's the role part. So this is the mnemonic. It's really easy to remember. When you talk about a role-playing game, there are three parts. There's the game, the play, and the role. The role part is portraying and accepting the reality of the game world by both the players and GMs, so that the players interact with the game world as if it were real, and the GMs portray the game world as if it were real. And there's a lot of things that can be involved with that, but a correctly predicated rules set will support all three of these factors. They will have rules that help the GM portray the world as if it were real. They will have an encumbrance, ammunition, food, and water are rules that help the GM portray the world as if it were real. So when you get rid of those rules, it undercuts the role part of a role-playing game, because the world is no longer as real as it used to be. Now, I'm convinced that this tripart definition, this tripart understanding of role-playing games, is the most complete and accurate understanding of role-playing games that has ever been formulated. I'm convinced that Gary Gygax knew this implicitly, that he understood it implicitly when he made AD&D, because this is baked into the rules of AD&D, but he had never explicitly defined it. And that everyone since then, because he didn't explicitly define it, they've kind of gone off the beam. They lost track of it. And they began being confused by things like, well, a role-playing game is like a story you and your friends tell together. It's not. It's a game. And it's a game with rules. So when you design a role-playing game, the rules you write need to support the game, the play, and the role. And if the rules you write aren't tailored to support those three aspects of a role-playing game, they don't work. They won't work. Or they'll work only halfway. They'll work only partially. They'll only work to a limited extent. But if you look at what AD&D does, the disease rules, to pick a random rule subsystem, support the reality of the game rules, game world. It supports the role part. I'm not saying every game needs disease rules like that. But a lot of games have them. Shadowrun has them. Torg has them. A lot of games have addiction rules. Shadowrun had them. Cyberpunk. had him. Cyberpunk 2020 had him. The three-part theory of, and the only two I can remember are gamist and simulationist, and it because it got torn up and rewritten to the GNS theory in 2000 is a complete misunderstanding of role-playing games, because they're trying to focus on one part of role-playing games and pull that out and say, okay, you can only have a game that does one part of this well. And it's not true. You need the game, you need the play of the game, and you need the role. Role-playing game. You need all three elements of that for the game to work, for playing the game to be entertaining and fun. And when you have a game that's built specifically to those three things, whose rules are predicated on those three things, then you've got a properly formulated role-playing game. And I'm not saying every other game but AD&D is wrong or bad, but those other games, the closer they hewed to the design philosophy in AD&D, or the more old-school AD&D they were, the better they were, and the further away they got from that, the worse they were. And pretty much since the year 2000, we've been getting further and further and further away from that. So that is the complete theory. When we were talking about this on the air a couple of weeks ago, I realized it was incomplete, and now I've completed it. And come up with a handy mnemonic so people can remember it. And it's tied right there in the name, role-playing game. You have the game, the play, and the role, so that anybody can remember it. The definition of the game, which is players acting in a role that, you know, it gives them game mechanical enhancements and game mechanical restrictions, trying to overcome obstacles set up by the game master in pursuit of some reward. Okay? That's what a game is. That's what a role-playing game is. The play, the gameplay loop, which is game master tells you the situation, asks what you're going to do, players tell what they're going to do, game master adjudicates the situation using the rules, tells the player the results, and describes a new situation, asks what they're going to do. That's the gameplay loop. And then the role. The players interact with the game world as if it were real, and the game master depicts the game world as if it were real. The game, the play, the role, the role-playing game, that is the complete sphere of how these games work. And any game which doesn't provide for all three of those things in concept and mechanics is incomplete or wrongly formulated. So that's why
I can't argue with that.
That's why those taking away those aspects of the rules undercuts the game, because they take away from the reality of the world. They remove tools that allow players to interact with the world as if it were real.
And you get all the undesired second and third order effects from that.
Yep.
Well, that's great. Let's leave it at there. Like I said, if you want to check out what's going on, check out my blog and DW. Do you have a blog post you want to push, or do we want to talk about movies first?
I just want to say one thing, folks. What you've just heard is a revolution in the understanding of role-playing games. It's the first explicit definition of role complete definition of role-playing games that has ever been formulated. So there it is.
Well done. To talk about some other dumb stuff we did this week. Some good stuff and some dumb stuff. Just real quick to bridge the two things. I finished up True Detective season 3. For some whiplash for everybody listening, season 3, it ended up being sort of like a standard detective story. With some nods to season 1, and some of the ending was a little disappointing and flat, and some of the ending was kind of sweet. Wasn't the kind of ending I was expecting out of True Detective season. It's all right. Seasons 1 and 2 are definitely worth watching. I can't give season 3 so much of a recommendation, but it was pretty good to watch. And there's some hilarious stuff in the 7th episode that I cannot spoil you. Let's just say that all of the, you know, anger and frustration that the characters have built up over the, you know, the first 6 episodes, and, you know, the main character gets to unleash, and it's hilarious. There's some great clippable, quotable bits of dialogue there. And I won't say any more than that. If you know, you know. So Warpig, do you think you're going to give those a try? Pretty binge-worthy. Oh, did I say binge-worthy? Forgive me. Let's see. Warpig, you might be talking at the mute, but anyway, I'm going to move on to the dumbest thing I've seen in a long time. And it's a movie from last year called Thanksgiving. And for some reason, I sat down with my wife for movie night. We just wanted to put something silly on. And yeah, there he goes. Warpig has left the building. He revolutionized RPGs, and that's it. We sat down and watched Thanksgiving. It happened to be promoted on one of the streaming services or another. And that's right, Thanksgiving. This is a horror flick, a slasher flick from 2023. Just playing on the streaming, you know, being promoted in the middle of February. This can't be a good sign. Well, oh my goodness, I wish Warpig were still here to hear this. I've been told his power went out, so who knows if we'll see him back again before the end of the show. But I tell you what, Thanksgiving is a slasher flick with a sort of I Know What You Did Last Summer vibe to it, where in the opening scene, a bunch of teenagers get into a bit of trouble. There's a hilarious murderous rampage at a store on Black Friday, which is held on Thanksgiving night for some reason, for obscure reasons. It's not important. What's important is that the same time next year, a killer is wiping out the teenagers and other people who were spotted causing trouble at this at this Walmart clone on Thanksgiving, on Black Friday Eve. And that's the setup. That setup's as dumb as it sounds. But I am not kidding you. In between all the absolutely ridiculous setups, there's a competent story that is with a bunch of great, and by great I mean hilarious, gory special effects. They successfully play a bunch of misdirection games to make you wonder who's going to turn out to be the surprise killer, knowing that in a genre like this, one of the characters you've seen is going to be the killer, and it's going to be really dumb when it's revealed. They have the violence and the gore. It's not super violent, but naturally, this is one of those slasher killers that just, for some reason, it's a regular person and he has superhuman strength. Welcome back, War Pig. I was just regaling our listeners with my review of Thanksgiving.
Awesome.
How's the power where you're at?
Still out.
Well, I'm glad your phone works. just for a quick recap, we have a stupid horror movie from last year. The story beats are sort of competent. And the gore and the violence are kind of over the top, where you're this small town group of high school kids is being hunted down one by one by a super killer. And yeah, of course, there's a person in this little town who turns into a superhuman Jason Voorhees style killer with super strength and toughness.
Do you remember Grindhouse?
I never saw Grindhouse.
Okay, so there were two movies in Grindhouse. One was Death Proof, and one was Planet Terror.
Oh, yeah, I remember that. I just never saw it.
And there were a bunch of fake trailers in Grindhouse for movies that didn't exist. Robert Rodriguez went and created one of the movies, which was Machete Kills. Or Machete, whichever. Well, Thanksgiving was one of the fake trailers in Grindhouse. and I believe it's by Eli Roth, if I'm not mistaken. And so he just decided to make the real movie that trailer was about.
Wow. I had no idea, but with that pedigree, with that background, I'm not surprised it came out the way that it did.
I don't know that it's entirely supposed to be a serious horror movie. I think it's kind of supposed to be a satire of a slasher movie.
Oh yeah, it is. I mean, the setup is absolutely ridiculous. The setup is completely ridiculous with, the instigating incident being a riot at a Walmart clone that ends up being fatal to a couple of people. Like it's Black Friday gone horribly wrong. And, you know, the killer's obviously getting vengeance for something that happened there. And the violence is ridiculous. Like all of this, you know, this regular, this, you know, this character from a small town, you know, whichever one of the characters in the movie ends up being the killer, so strong that he, you know, twists some kid's head around without, you know, breaking the neck or breaking the skin on the neck or anything like that. Just crack like that with one swift motion. Completely absurd levels of strength and toughness from the killer, in Scooby-Doo fashion ends up, you know, being one of the other characters, right? You find out who it is at the end. It definitely it sort of has those competently written beats that you'd expect from a horror film. And nothing about this film takes itself seriously. I mean, the characters play it straight. There's no sort of winking at the fourth wall. No winking at the camera, no fourth wall break. Although that would have ruined the film. Well, such as it is. Completely ridiculous. Warpig, you would love it. Just watch it already. So dumb, so dumb, so ridiculous. But unlike a lot of dumb and ridiculous movies at the end, I was like, yeah, that was fun. Oh my goodness, so much gore. I don't really have that much else to say about it. You know what you're getting. It is what it says on the tin.
All right. I have nothing to add. I haven't seen it, so. And actually, I haven't seen any movies or books. I haven't seen any movies or TV shows recently. I'm still watching Masters of the Air. It's still a great show. Looking forward to doing a full review of it. I still haven't gotten back to Halo, despite what I said last week. People are saying episode 4 gets better. I don't know. I'm not willing to sit through the rest of episode 3 to 5 out. I'm done. I checked out. It wasn't worth it. I have endured too much pain.
I get it. I get it.
There are a few movies on the horizon that I am looking forward to. And I didn't mean that to be a pun, but I just saw a trailer today for Kevin Costner. Actually, he's been trying to earn his way back into being trusted by working in, you know, prestige projects on television. And finally, someone trusted him enough to give him money to make a new movie. So he made a Western called Horizon, An American Dream. And that's coming out this year. So the teaser trailer they released yesterday looked awful. The trailer looked good. I don't know, but I'm willing to give it a chance. So I'm looking forward to that. I'm looking forward to Deadpool. And there were a couple other movies that looked like they kind of might be okay, but man, pickings is slim out there right now.
Mm-hmm.
Sony is apparently releasing two more of their Spider-Man adjacent movies that don't have Spider-Man in them.
Like Madame Web?
Yeah, like Madame Web. Venom 3 is coming out this year. And a movie about the Hunter, whose name I can't remember. Kraven, the Hunter. A movie about him is coming out this year. And then Marvel has put out a bunch of, you know, releases that got put up as news stories, saying how they're retooling the studio and stuff because they only have one movie this year and it's Deadpool. But they've got stuff releasing on streaming, which just looks awful. They've got the Darkhold Diaries, which is about the evil witch from the Red Witch series, Scarlet Witch series, excuse me, Agatha, which nobody wanted, nobody's going to watch. They've got, I think, one more series releasing this year, which is so memorable, I can't even remember it. And then next year, they've got Captain America 4 with Sam Wilson as Captain America. Supposedly, they've got a show called The Thunderbolts, which is basically Marvel's Suicide Squad. And I'm not even making that up. It's a bunch of anti-heroes who are get sent on missions that they're supposed to die on. It is literally Marvel's Suicide Squad.
That's great.
It's not even a stretch. It's not even a pretend, you know. I'm not even ribbing Marvel to say they're ripping it off. It's literally, they go on missions where they're supposed to die. It's the Suicide Squad. You know, it's got the fake Captain America from the series. So if you saw the series, which no one did, this Falcon, the Winter Soldier series.
Yeah, nobody watched it. Yeah.
Except me. And it's got the Russian Captain America and Florence Pugh from the Black Widow movie, which nobody really saw. And a Ghost from the second Ant-Man movie, which people watched and some people liked, but she wasn't really a strong part of that movie. And then it's got the Diane from Seinfeld, if you remember her. I don't remember what the actress's name is. Julie Louis-Dreyfus. She played like a CIA contact. So she's the Amanda Waller of the team, is also in it. And just the excitement for this couldn't be found with a stethoscope. You know, the rumbles on the internet couldn't be detected with a stethoscope. Nobody, the Marvel Universe is dead. It has no pulse, no excitement. Nobody wants to see any of these movies. And it's the same for Star Wars. They're releasing another Star Wars series this year called The Acolyte. And I remember reading what it was about at one time. I can't remember anything. But nobody wants to see it. I haven't bothered to see the last one they released, which was about the Padawan who was assigned to Anakin Skywalker in the Clone Wars series. So she became a really popular breakout character there, and she has made guest appearances here and there in like The Mandalorian and a couple of other places. And they gave her entire series, and it kind of bombed because they just did what Kathleen Kennedy always does and what Disney always does. So yeah, that was unexciting, and none of the rest of their upcoming slate of stuff has caused people to be excited about it. It's not like people even hate it anymore, except the most diehard people. People just don't care. And that's the absolute worst spot for a company to be in. When people have just stopped caring, when they've turned around and walked away to other things, it's worse than starting from scratch. They've just been burned out. They don't want to know. You're dead to them. You know? You've got a track record and it's all bad, and they're over you. Too bad, so sad, see ya. You were pursuing a new audience and they weren't there. They didn't come out, and you drove your old audience away
if they just hated your movies, that would at least be something, because you could win them back with good stuff. But once you've burned them out so much that they just walked away, well,
you get what you deserve.
Yeah. So, I don't know. It is James Gunn's reboot of the DCU has yet to materialize. I think it's coming out next year. So we'll see if people like that or all. Warner Brothers has been absolutely disastrous with its DCU. I mean, it's had some decent movies, but most of them have been absolutely terrible. Zack Snyder is a phenomenal visual director, but he should never be let near a script. He just should not write a story. He was strongest when other people wrote the story and he was trying to follow it as closely as he could. When Frank Miller wrote the story for 300 in the comic book, and Zack was trying to follow it, Jack Snyder was trying to follow it as closely as he could, was basically using the comic as storyboard and script for the movie. He made phenomenal stuff. Same with Watchmen. But when he started doing his own original stories, things just came apart. Which is why the only good part of Sucker Punch were the four fights, because they were all visual and no story. All action, no story. That was the only good part of that movie. And those four fights are absolutely incredible. Some of the best high concept fights put to film. But his ability to tell a story or to write a story, he's just not a writer. You know, in Rebel Moon, he wrote that story and it was awful, the story. Again, some of the fights in there were just amazing. Just fabulous. But the story was soporific. And it's sad because he wasted a lot of great talent and great imagery on a really mediocre story.
It's a shame.
So, we are in a vast, and I know we discussed this either last week or I think it was last week where we compared, you know, 1986 theater to modern theater. We're in this vast drought of storytelling where people can't tell stories to save their lives anymore. And they are focused on hiring writers for any reason other than their ability to tell stories. And all the seasoned, skilled storytellers are being sidelined and are beginning to age out of the industry. And all of the young, potentially skilled writers are not being brought up. They're not being taught how to tell stories. And it's tragic. But Masters of the Air is good. I've enjoyed that.
That's something anyway. I mean, I can't disagree. I wish I had more to say about it, but yeah, of course.
The thing I like about Masters of the Air is that it touches on every aspect of the experience of bomber crews in World War II. So because it's following And apparently it all comes from one book. One of the things that sunk Pacific is that it was based on two different books that were kind of spliced together, and it felt like it. It was really disjointed. The Masters of the Air is based on one unit and one book. And so the various things that these pilots and crews went through as part of this 100th Squadron cover the gamut of the possible experiences that you could have as a pilot in that war. And so without having to distort the story or twist things around, you see a lot of different things happen to them. And it's really, there's enough variety in the events to keep you, to keep the story moving and to, you know, kind of, obviously they've had to fictionalize some things and combine characters and whatnot. They had to do that with Band of Brothers too, but it was believable enough. I mean, it may not have been the literal truth, but it was honest, if you can see the difference there, what I'm saying.
Yeah, I get it.
It was honest to the experience. And man, I get that infantrymen were stuck down in the dirt and were freezing. And that if they made it home, pilots went back to warm bunks. But air crews in those flying fortresses, flying daylight missions over Germany, they did not have it easy. It was absolutely not any easier for them than it was for people on the ground. And maybe I'll talk about this more in my full review of it. I grew up in a town called Schweinfurt, in Germany, and it's a ball bearing manufacturing town, and was during World War II. And the town is just filled with these parks all over the place, these beautiful parks. And they're called rubble parks because the entire town was flattened by the end of the war, just utterly destroyed. And so what they did was, they had bulldozers just take all the rubble of the town and scoop them into massive piles and then put dirt and grass and trees on top of them. So, and then rebuilt the town. So all these rubble parks, these gorgeous places with, you know, with walking paths through them and pretty trees and lovely grass and everything, were just built on top of what remained of this strategically important town that had been flattened by Allied bombing raids. And you have to flatten Schweinfurt to win the war because tanks won't go without ball bearings. Half tracks won't go without ball bearings. Planes won't fly without ball bearings. You know, staff cars won't drive without ball bearings. So the town had to be destroyed to stop the Nazi Germany war machine. But it really is a different way to grow up. I spent 8 years living in and around that town. And, you know, to this day, it is marked still by World War II, and it always will be. They're beautiful, these rubble parks, but they're kind of, you know, scars of that conflict from 80 years ago. So it's really, really different to think about And I'm not saying that's bad. I'm not trying to cast aspersions on the U.S. It was utterly necessary to win that war, and it was utterly necessary to fight that war. But finally getting to see the stories of the people, this particular unit didn't bomb Schweinfurt, but a unit like them did, and finally getting to see, you know, the war from their eyes is just really fascinating to me on kind of a personal level. So, yeah, I'm enjoying the show.
Well, it's actually a really good story. And I don't have anything to add. I do love a good war story, but that whole Band of Brothers phenomenon missed me by. I guess we should wrap up War Pig, but we want to wrap up with some amazing announcements.
Yes.
What have you got going on for us?
The blog is live, and it is at geek-gab.com. Our Patreon and Subscribestar are both live right now. And right now they both only have one donation level apiece. That's $5 a month for people who want to support the show. The links are in the description, but they're at Subscribestar/geek-gab or Subscribestar.com, Patreon.com/geekgab. And again, links to the blog and both of those are in the notes below. We are considering setting up a Discord for the show, but that is down the road. And if you have any suggestions for perks that you might like to see added to a higher donation tier, please let us know, and we will see about adding those. But I did not want to debut the Subscribestar or the Patreon until we had something extra to offer. And now that the blog is live and we're putting up regular posts on it, we have something extra to offer. We have expanded the show and things are going well. We've got a lot of great posts up on there and have for a couple weeks now. And we really ask you to go to either of those sites and help support the show.
I love it. I love it. I'm looking forward to see what else comes out of it. I love that we finally have that option for you guys. And, you know, you've been pretty consistently putting out blog posts, and I want to see that take off. Great announcement. I don't have anything to add. Daddy Warpig, I think I'm going to call it a night. Thanks so much for hanging out in live chat. And I hope everybody listening later checks out. First of all, call your friends, set up a D&D night, play some D&D. Watch Thanksgiving if you want a stupid popcorn movie. Do check out the blog. Do check out the Patreon and Subscribestar. Really cool stuff, Warpig. And thanks for, as always, being amazing.
All right, folks. I want to thank everybody who tuned in live and jumped in our chat. And I want to thank everybody who will tune in later. You can get us on Google Play Store, on the iTunes Store, or on SoundCloud.com just to a search for Geek Gab. We are here on YouTube.com/GeekGab every week at 10 p.m. Eastern, 7 p.m. Pacific. And we are also archived on YouTube, so you can check out any of our great and glorious shows here on Geek Gab. We are signing out for today. Don't forget to subscribe and click the bell icon to be notified when we go live. And click like. We are signing out for today, folks. But don't you worry. Don't you fret. We will be back.